Hello and welcome to Leadership Amplified. I'm Dr. Karen Morley and I'm delighted to bring you another podcast episode where we profile leaders who are great role models and who inspire us to continue to be curious about just what good leadership is and to show us how to do it. Susan Ratcliffe is my guest for this episode. Susan is one of my favourite kinds of people. She's a female engineer. Amongst other things, of course. Increasing the number of women in engineering is work in progress, and given the low numbers that are currently enrolling to study engineering, it's something that we really need to change. And what better way to do that, and what better way to promote the profession than through hearing the stories of women like Sue who've chosen this path. Sue spent 13 years working for Rio Tinto in engineering roles in Australia and overseas, and she worked in areas such as mine closure and land use and water efficiency. She joined Melbourne Water just over a decade ago, and her roles there have been in strategy, innovation and business improvement, showing the relevance of engineering to a whole range of career paths, not just the traditional ones. Her current role is as Program Director of Integration and Simplification, and she leads an enterprise-wide program to reduce red tape and bureaucracy. So welcome, Susan. It's great to have you on the podcast today. So let's find out a bit more about your wonderful leadership journey. Really interested in the challenges that you've faced, what's helped you to create the success that you've experienced, and particularly, as you know, given the interest in being an engineer in a male-dominated world, if you can focus on that as well, that would be terrific.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to sort of think through in terms of that journey and how it's influenced where I am today, what I learned during particularly the earlier part of my career in that space. And I was, you know, thank you for sending some of the questions through a little early because it gave me a chance to really reflect on this because it's not something that I often sit with and sort through in my mind. But what were the goods and the bads, particularly about starting my career in the mining industry, which is highly male dominated, but it's also got a really hyper masculine kind of culture to it. And I was thinking about all of the feedback, I suppose, I got as an early leader and the expectations that were set around what leadership looked like in the mining industry. And at the time it was, well, leadership looked like being that kind of hyper masculine man. And so you know, and I'm not one of those. I'm 5'2" and I'm got a feminine figure, and I tend to, you know, I'm expressive and I can, you know, be sort of emotional. I'm certainly not, you know, I've never been described, I think, as someone who's kind of very steady and even in terms of, you know, my, I suppose, emotional state. So I have highs and lows and I have laughter and I had, you know, frustration, and I tend to express all of those fairly openly. And certainly when you first start in that kind of an industry, the expectation is that, you know, when you look to a leader and you go, well, what does it take to be a leader in this industry? What you see is this kind of, you know, very stoic kind of masculine, tough man. And it does make it difficult for you, particularly for me in my early 20s, to kind of imagine what kind of a leader I was going to be and how I could be that leader. So I think I was, you know, I'll say the word guilty of, but I think at the time I didn't realise that, I think it just was. I don't know if I was doing myself a disservice or it was just one of those things you have to learn, but I kind of emulated that sort of, I sort of masculined myself up, for want of a better word, and I emulated my leaders at the time. And so I felt quite disconnected from myself as a leader in the leadership I was performing and the leadership that I sort of felt inside of myself. And so I don't think I was a very good leader for a lot of my 20s because, you know, if I reflect back to, you know, a leader is someone who'll take you somewhere that you wouldn't have gone on your own. If the person you're looking to has this sort of disconnection. If you're a leader and you don't know yourself, then how can you expect others to sort of follow you or trust you in that journey? So I think I was probably a manager rather than a leader through a lot of my 20s because I just hadn't found, you know, and now we use the term authentic self, and how to express that authentic self in this hyper-masculine environment. That being said, you know, my role was to be put on a plane and sent somewhere and to fix the problem. So I kind of had to land wherever I land, you know, work out the problem quickly, establish relationships, navigate the politics, and deliver on an outcome. So what I was, the flip side of that is I was learning a lot of the resilience and confidence that is necessary, I think, to become a good leader later on. I just don't think I saw it then as one of those tools that I learned at the time that I rely on today through that. So
And I mean, you're outlining one of the critical things that does stop it, women from choosing engineering and certain professions, because you just can't imagine yourself in that profession. You can't see yourself being like that because there are such differences. And it is extremely difficult to navigate in that context. And it's really interesting that you talk about masculinizing yourself in order to fit, because you either stay unmasculine and you don't fit, or you try to fit by being masculine and then you don't fit with yourself. So this is damned if you do, doomed if you don't trap.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you, did you realize that that was what it was going to be like when you were doing engineering and as you started your career, or was it you landed there and all of a sudden it was like, hang on, what is this?
I think I went into it with rose-colored glasses on, and I suppose, ironically, I should have looked at the fact that there was, you know, only sort of six other women doing, you know, maths, straight maths and sciences in the high school I went to understand that it was, you know, going to be challenging, it was going to be difficult, and, you know, that there was only 10% of women in my engineering class. I should have realised that I was still going to be a minority, but I still had this sense, and I think, you know, because I grew up perhaps, you know, during those 70s and 80s that I could, that women were kind of cracking the world, right? You know, and by the time I got there, these issues would have been resolved by the women before me, because the world was changing. And while it was changing, it was not changing nearly as fast as I expected it to. And I think going through university years, all of us have this kind of utopic period about, you know, how the world's going to be amazing. And we all become quite sort of liberalized and political during our university years. And so we kind of assume that the world is changing the same way as we're changing. And it just wasn't. So I landed and I felt really out of my depth. And, you know, and I was experiencing those challenges where I'd put forward a technical idea and everyone would go, oh yeah, that could work. And then I'd hear another male counterpart put forward almost exactly the same idea. I'm like, oh, yes, we should try to make that work. And it was just this real subtle, your idea might work. It's worth, it's testing. Whereas the other one was kind of felt with, oh, that's a good idea. I reckon that could work. You know, and there was this automatic acceptance of this technical idea because somehow mine was kind of less formed. And you're also constantly getting feedback from your managers around, oh, you're pretty emotional and, gee, you like to chat to people, don't you? And you kind of feel like, oh, I'm that kid that's getting in trouble for talking too much in class or being too sociable or yes, I'm emotional. I've really got to calm down those emotions, you know. And when they say emotional, it's not because I'm crying at work or any of those things. It's about having highs and lows or being expressive or being able to articulate a problem, you know, by using the word, I feel like this isn't the right way to go, rather than, you know, I think that, da, 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 da. And all these things you don't learn how to rephrase when you're in your 20s. No one teaches you that. Certainly your male bosses don't teach you that because they don't even realise that it's a thing. And so I think you do, you just feel really, you know, exactly as you said, you feel really disconnected. But because you're going through your 20s and you're going through so much transition, I don't think you realise until, you know, it comes in hindsight, not in foresight, exactly what the problem is that you're trying to solve. And if you just solve that, then you'd be a better leader. And everyone's saying you need to be a better leader. And you're like, okay, I'm trying really, really hard to give all the feedback that you're giving me about being a better leader, but I feel like I'm moving further and further away from the leader I could be by following your advice. And now I'm really confused.
And so you said that there was the flip side, and that going into different environments and needing to sort of fix problems helped you to see things differently. So what was it that helped you to become connected as a leader, to feel a better sense of your own fit for leadership roles, or in fact to reimagine leadership in the light of more of your personality and your style?
I think part of it, you know, and it's hard when you're a younger leader to, you know, everyone says, you know, as you get older, you feel more in touch with your own skin. And as you get more experience and your self-confidence improves, you start to feel safer to try new things your own way. And I think what happens is, you know, and I'll say to some of the people that I work with now, some of the women I work with now, if you want to try being a little more authentic, a bit more yourself, just let that out in a safe environment. So find a meeting where it's worth giving it a try, or find a project that's low risk and try just letting yourself be yourself, and then watch the feedback you get from others. And what will happen is you'll find that more people want to work with you and more people want to trust you, or they'll come with you on a more difficult journey, because when you're authentic, another human feels like they can trust you because they kind of know you. So they'll come with you on those more impossible journeys. And I think I was given I took on a couple of big projects kind of in my early 30s, and I had no idea what I was doing. In hindsight, I now know, and I'll say to others, unless you are uncomfortable and you're feeling out of your depth and you're working through that, then you're probably not ready for your next leadership challenge. Because as a leader, the further you move up that leadership sort of hierarchy, if you like, the less often you'll know what you're doing, the more often you'll feel out of your depth. And for anyone who thinks that, you know, you look at the leaders who go, oh, well, once you're at that level, then of course you know exactly what you're doing and you're always in control. You might have a surface vision of that. You might be, you know, but underneath, every day you're probably out of your depth more often than you're not. And so I think it wasn't until I worked out that I do really well when I'm a little bit out of my depth, and I was getting feedback from others and people wanted to work with me on projects. And it took, you know, a few years of kind of getting this positive reinforcement about the way that you're tackling this is working and people want to work with you and they actually appreciate your leadership style, that you slowly, you know, grow into your sense of self as a leader. It wasn't an instant thing. It certainly didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. And then there are some of the, for me, there was at least one issue, I think, the moment that a couple of things happened for me, and it was a particularly difficult project I was working on, and I was working, you know, and it was one of those projects where it was high profile and couldn't get lots of leaders to agree on the project, on the direction and the like, and we had a deliverable and I was behind on this deliverable because I couldn't get agreement, bipartisan agreement, on what we needed to do next. And my manager at the time, my general manager at the time, was really, really frustrated, and in a meeting, you know, lost his temper, had a go at me in front of lots of my male colleagues. And, you know, there's that moment where you feel the tingle in your eyes and you think, crap, I'm going to cry at work and I don't want to do that. And then you feel the tear run down your face and you're like, damn it, everyone can see this now. And, you know, and he turned to me and said, you're clearly not coping. And whereas in the past I would have gone, yes, okay, thank you for the feedback, blah, 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 and sort of turned in on myself, I think I was just frustrated enough, tired enough, or had enough self-awareness to say, hang on, no, this isn't me not coping. Me not coping would be me saying, I want off this project, leaving the room, or not staying in this room right now trying to solve the problem with everybody. This is me just expressing frustration the same way as, you know, one of any of you, pointing to my male colleagues, might express that frustration by beating a squash ball to death at a squash game or going home and drinking beer. This is just my version of that, and it's no different to the way you might express that. Aren't I lucky that I get to express it in this particular way? And it was one of those moments where I think I might have just opened my mouth and I've either put my foot in it really big time, or I've actually said something profound and I'm not really sure what the silence is in the room. And it turned out But in the most part, particularly my male colleagues, they were like, yeah, she's right. You know, she's just said something kind of big and we all need to sit with this. Whereas my GM, he wasn't ready to hear that and he was in a difficult spot. So he didn't give me the positive feedback. What's interesting though now is I can pretty much call on any one of those colleagues and they will happily work on a project with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so sometimes there are those big moments where you walk out of a meeting room and go, oh, wow, I did that. And I really said that. And I actually really felt that. It was a really authentic outburst from me. Mm. And now I'm prepared to own it. And I will say to other people when, you know, women that I've worked with since then, particularly, you know, if you haven't cried at work, you probably haven't tried hard enough. You know, there are times where, you know, it's, and what I'm trying to say to them is it's actually okay for that to have happened. And I'm happy to sit with you in a meeting as a leader and for you to have a tear about frustration. I'm not going to stop it and I'm not going to crawl in the employee, you know, assistance program and the like. We're just going to acknowledge that emotions in the workplace are okay. You know, and obviously being female isn't just that, but it's about having that diversity of experience and a diversity of style, you know, across a group.
But I think what you're saying that there's kind of a piece in there that's about emotional expression, but there's also, to me, it just, you know, it's about your vulnerability. And in that conversation with the GM and your peers, what obviously came across to them was where the authenticity came from was your vulnerability, being open to say what they probably felt themselves or had experienced themselves at other times. And it's the vulnerability that creates that sort of connection, that human connection that transcends gender. And however you're going to express these things, whether there are gender differences or not, you know, it is that openness and that vulnerability that really connects you through to people. So that, you know, that sounds like that was a really profound moment, as you said, for yourself, but for them too.
Yeah. I think it was. And again, at the time, I didn't recognize it for everything it was. And it probably wasn't until I went to a Brené Brown, you know, presentation where we're talking about, you know, courage and vulnerability being the same in each other that I went, yeah, people will follow a leader, you know, into something scary if they know that that leader's got bravery, which also equates vulnerability, right? I'm not going to follow somebody into a slightly scary or vulnerable situation if I don't trust them, or if I don't think they're brave enough or courageous enough to lead me through that space safely. And so without realizing it, at the same time as expressing that vulnerability, you're also expressing courage and you're encouraging people to follow you when those leadership challenges get really hard. But if you'd asked me in my 20s what that was, I would have had no idea. I really wouldn't have got that message. It just didn't make any sense to me. And I think I'm still comprehending that journey of leadership and vulnerability and the power of vulnerability and the terrifying nature of vulnerability that comes with it. That's still something I'm working on now.
Yeah. Occasionally it can backfire. You're open and the response doesn't come back to you. And I think that's one of the challenges too for women. And quite a few women that I speak with do recognize that they put up more boundaries around themselves and their authenticity, just for all the reasons that you've been saying already. And so it can be a bit harder to be vulnerable as well. And then the hyper-masculine world kind of says, well, don't be vulnerable because you have to play this role of the, you know, masculinity. So we end up being very far away from our true selves. So I'm really enjoying this focus that you've got around authenticity and the sense of, you know, connecting yourself to your role and how that's played out for you.
And it's interesting under COVID right now, it's playing out in a more profound way than I ever expected to, because all of those professional veneers that we put on when we're in offices and we're not, you know, working from home in, you know, and our slippers and our hoodies and our family are all around us, or, you know, or perhaps, you know, your cat's walking across, you know, all sorts of things that happen. And it's interesting around, you almost can't hide from your authenticity now. And I'm kind of glad that I was starting to get comfortable with my authenticity as a leader and sort of being myself, because now there's no hiding any of myself from the people that I work with and work for, because, you know, I'm on Skype, my kids will walk through the back of the thing, they'll come in, they'll ask me a question about maths or their spelling test or something, or the dog will bark because there's a delivery person here, or my partner will be on the phone for his business or whatever that is. There's none of that professional veneer. It's very hard to maintain, and you can try. And I do have colleagues and friends at the moment who are trying to maintain that professional veneer. But it for many people, that's very, very difficult. So if you hadn't already embraced this idea of kind of being an authentic leader, you're probably really, really feeling this hard. You're learning it now on the job, in the moment, under pressure. And I think that's, we've come full circle.
Yes.
On being told that be an authentic leader. And now we're like, you are an authentic leader, really, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we flip from, you know, your career and some of the important lessons about leadership and stay with the present focus, what do you see as being the real opportunities post-COVID, or, you know, assuming there's a phase that's post-COVID, what do you think the real advantages for leadership are?
Well, I think we're doing a lot of learning, and I think sitting in a leadership course, we've all probably done that over our careers, and talking about leadership is a very, it's useful and it's helpful, and it gives you lots of dot points to reflect on later on, and we all go away and we practice those things. I think the difference is now the intensity. We've kind of gone from a workshop style learning environment to a boot camp style learning environment. So right now we're practicing a lot of those leadership skills that we might have been taught in a lot of those modern leadership workshops and the like. We're now having to practice those in the moment, in real time, under pressure. So we're probably all well into that double loop learning at this point in time about what that looks like. I think. So that's one thing. We're practicing those skills of authenticity and managing diversity in a way that we would never have, within intensity we probably wouldn't have had if we'd stayed in our in our office type environments with our professional veneers on. I think the other thing I'm noticing is how differently I now know my people that that I lead. And, you know, I knew them as professional entities, and I knew them very well as professional entities, and we had really wonderful, high-performing team type, conversations and the like, and we work together really well. I've loved the team that I've got at the moment for a really long time, and I don't really want any of them to ever leave, because it's one of those utopic moments for me. But I now know those people as whole people, with all of their challenges, what colour their dogs are, how old their kids are, whether their internet is good or bad, whether they're morning or afternoon people. I know them in a whole of person sense that I didn't know about them before. And I think that's a good thing. I think, though, it does require a slightly different type of relationship between a leader and their people, because once you know somebody in that kind of much more personal way as a whole of person, I think the onus on making them feel safe and trusted is different, because then you it's easy when your boss just knows you and you're from the 9 to 5 and you're in your suit and tie, but when your boss knows you when you're in your pajamas or when you've just yelled at your kids for the third time, that's a very different kind of honest relationship, and there's a lot more vulnerability in that. So I do think it will change the way we work. I think we've all had to be more disciplined about how we connect with people and when we connect with our people and what we connect with them about. In this environment, I've had some success in just connecting with them about the work. I've had significant success when I connect with them about not only the work but also them and what's happening in their personal life, and engaging with them about other more human matters. So I think we aren't, on the flip side of COVID, if that ever happens, I think we're going to know our people differently, and we'll probably interact with them differently as leaders for the rest of our working time. What that means is as you move on to your next leadership challenge, or you move to a different organization and you're forming new relationships, I don't know, but certainly it means that your existing relationships with your existing professional relationships, they will never probably look the same or feel the same as they did before COVID.
So what do you think the real difference is? What are people kind of feeling, and what are they doing in response to the depth of relationship and connection that you're creating?
It depends on the person on the relationship you have with your leader. If your leader was somebody who was more of a manager, then I suspect right now you probably aren't. If I use the words of high performing team, you know, when we were in an office based environment, you might have been able to say as leader, my team is high performing. Here are my high performing metrics. They're clearly a high performing team. I think what we'll find now is that unless a leader is prepared to engage, or the people are prepared to engage with leader, it's a two-way relationship. If there isn't that vulnerability and trust that comes with sharing that further part of yourself with your leader, then what was perhaps a high-performing team will shift, and you'll find them not performing as well, and they'll move back to just kind of an everyday team. The teams at the moment who, you know, from my experience, the teams at the moment who've been able to stay high-performing and keep their high-performance metrics going, or their employee engagement scores up, are those who have been prepared to shift into that kind of more leadership space and the more vulnerable spaces or the braver spaces than those leaders who are still kind of just making sure that everybody gets their work done and it's kind of, they're going through the motions, but they haven't engaged with their people in a human way. That's my observation. I mean, it's only early days, early being 6 months in, but that seems to be, what I'm starting to observe is those teams that will make it and thrive are those that have been prepared to go there and examine a different kind of relationship in that model. I certainly have also noticed that leaders who liked hierarchy, that hierarchy's kind of been lost quite a lot. And if that was one of the tools you used, it's probably not there for you to use right now, because everyone can ring you on Skype at any time or through Teams, whatever tool you're using. And so you're engaging with different people in your teams differently. And you're not using those traditional hierarchy models necessarily to do it. It's kind of open slather, isn't it? So it's that social media way of doing business, and it's different to those old-fashioned hierarchical leadership styles that we all had before COVID.
Yeah. And when you're working with your team collectively, I'm really keen to know what sort of practices or techniques, or, you know, how are you doing that so that you get that good engagement through the technology, but, you know, in a team context, not just one-to-one.
You talked about good leaders need to listen well and need to know when to not talk. I think that has been a really important skill. I've had to, you know, I'm a chatter, so I need to practice to be quiet, so that it allows space in a Zoom context or in whatever context you're using for someone to speak up. You've also, if you're an extrovert, you've got to allow those silences where people come off mute and do some thinking and all that sort of stuff. Unless you're prepared to practice those more active listening and patience style, you're not going to be able to hear everything that your team wants to say. And so, it's interesting, there is a practice around trying to collaborate across a digital forum that is very different from having butcher's paper and sticky notes in an office. And no one's really taught us that. I certainly haven't been taught how to do that digitally. What I have done is thrown that challenge out to my team as well and said, anyone who has a successful workshop, bring back your ideas and share them with everybody else. Say, we tried this, and this worked really well, but this didn't work well. One of the things we've learned is if you need to do kind of a workshop, and on some tools you can't see everyone's videos at the same time as, you know, seeing the work that you're working on. So I allocate two people to those workshops now, one to watch the video and do the room watching and see who's engaged and who's not engaged, or perhaps who, you know, there's always somebody in a workshop that's sort of, they would like to say something, but they don't feel that they can. So that person is responsible for watching the room and making sure everybody's participating, or if if they're not agreeing, that we make sure that we collect that information, because the kind of work I do around business improvement, what I'm really looking for is the divergence, not for the conformance, because I know that, you know, that's great if everybody agrees that this is conforming, but that's not why something's not necessarily broken. It's because there's some differences that we haven't picked up on. So I'm looking for the divergence. So I need somebody to actually physically do that, as well as the person who's facilitating and writing it down. So we've had to adapt and put two people in those environments to be able to manage still getting that collective work on a digital forum. But we worked that out through trial and error.
Yeah, and but that's really sensible. One of the things that I've noticed is that in transferring to a virtual environment, people have not done a transfer. If you think about what's worked like normally when we're together or whatever our traditional way of working was, and then think, okay, we're in a different environment now, let's figure out how you translate or transfer that. I think people maybe have frozen a little bit around that. Whereas what you're saying that makes great sense to me is, let's look at what was working and now let's make that work, but figure out how to do it in this different environment that we've got. And yeah. So we allocate roles or we do it in this particular way. So that makes a great deal of sense. And that's still picking up on all of the same cues, but using different ways to do that.
It's also giving, by you saying, I don't know how to do this well, it's also giving your people permission to try something new. And if it doesn't quite work out, well, on you for trying. What did we work out? So there is a little bit more permission. Pardon me for coughing. There is a little bit more permission for us to try new things. They know I'm up for it. So they're allowed to be up for it as well. And I know that just comes back to that whole, I'm prepared to be an adaptive leader. I don't know everything about everything. I'm learning just as fast as they are. And I'm dead honest about that, because I think to do anything else right now would be a lie.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So if you don't mind, Susan, I'd like to come back to a bit of where we started, but really focusing back around gender balance in leadership, thinking about some of the lessons you think you've learned, why you think it's important.
Yep.
I guess particularly if you're thinking about younger women, why they should move into engineering degrees, for example, as a career path into leadership, you know, how they're going to have a different experience than the one that you had, and how to navigate themselves for success. That's a huge question, but Suze, I know you're up for it.
I was going to say, how do we get more women in STEM?
Yes.
It's interesting. So first of all, I think that there's the more women like myself that talk about the challenges and kind of demystify how terrifying it kind of is, and encourage other women to do that, to say, actually, I'm prepared to emulate what a leader with an engineering degree looks like. At least they know, you know, it's risky for me, but by putting myself out there, I'm hopefully at least giving them an opportunity to look at someone and go, all right, there's someone a little bit like me who's managed to make it work. So it raises my confidence to give it a go, and for it to not be so daunting. But I think also, the language is changing, and it is slow. And I know that, you know, some people will debate gender targets and the like, but I think that until you can see other women leaders doing the job, you know, involving the job, being the job, we're going to sit flatlined in that, you know, 10 to 15% of engineers every year a female, and we're really not moving that. And it's interesting, we really haven't moved that a lot in the last decade. There has to be examples of success, and we need ways of celebrating that. But then when we do put those women out there, I think we also need to make sure that they're prepared to be authentic and kind of talk about the challenges, and to be able to say, you know, when I've been mentoring some of the female engineers I work with at the moment, the younger ones, and I'll say, oh, yeah, I always used to get in feedback that I spent too much time talking to people when I was making a cup of coffee. And I'm like, yes, I get that too. And I'm like, the bit that they don't get now is that later on when they've got a really tricky project and they need people to collaborate with them, all of those incidental things that you've done that might have irritated your male colleagues because they didn't do it, they'll actually stand you in good stead because you'll be able to put your hand up or you'll be able to reach out to those people you've built those relationships and you'll be able to say, brainstorm with me why this isn't working, and you'll get a completely different piece of information or a diverse opinion, and it will make the difference for what you need to do. But you won't see this happen right away. It's not going to be straightforward. I think making sure that our female leaders or STEM women get access to good coaching and support so that they can, you know, I would have really loved in my 20s someone to sit down and say, the more I try to be the leader that everybody's describing to me, the less I feel like myself. I had no one to really explore that disconnection with. Mm. And I think if someone could have said to me, that's okay, just sit with it and watch how this goes, this is kind of normal or whatever it is, I probably would have gone, all right, and had the self-confidence to keep doing that rather than perhaps, you know, sort of losing traction for a couple of years, feeling like I was somehow the mistake. And once your self-confidence is down, it's really hard to lead others or for them to want to come with you. So, you know, there are so many things that we need to do. Generosity of leaders is also really, really important. Taking, you know, I think about some of the years where all of a sudden I had, I learned a lot very quickly or where my career advanced rapidly. I finally managed to sneak myself over onto a project where I got to work with someone, a leader that I admired. Steve, I admired him as a leader for quite some time, and it took me a couple of years to manage to finagle myself onto a project under him. But he was the sort of leader that would invite you to come with him into a meeting, even a high-risk meeting or a difficult meeting, so that you could see how those conversations occurred. You could watch somebody else practice those skills. You know, it's kind of like see one, do one, teach one. And, you know, as we bring young women into that STEM environment, if we want them to stay, we need to be prepared to bring them with us and say, this is how I navigate myself authentically in this pressured environment, and how I manage those conversations and how I do it so that you can see what that looks like. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting, you know, for me is there will be leaders who are prepared to do that with you and to take somebody with you, because that's a vulnerable exercise in its own right. If you're a leader and you're trying to build your own profile, taking somebody with you means technically in that moment you're diluting, could a potential of diluting your profile, unless they perform well, in which case suddenly you look fantastic because you've got this great person working for you and then you look wonderful. But doing those sorts of things and being prepared to do those sorts of things, that every time I do that thing, I'm hopefully creating another, you know, woman in science who will be able to continue. And the more we have, the more successful they are, the higher profile they become, the less rare and special they are, and the more women we start to see in STEM. It's interesting. I've got a 10-year-old daughter and, you know, she loves maths and science, but she's already being kind of picked on a little bit by her friends because it's not cool to like maths. And I'm kind of like, yeah, it's cool. Your mum's cool. Like, and she's like, well, you're not really cool, mum. You're not really that cool. I'm like, well, I can just pretend.
Yeah. Who's the picking on by?
Well, by other women, other girls.
Yeah.
And I don't, and this is where I kind of don't get it. Because, you know, in grade five, you shouldn't know that girls don't like nerdy stuff. It's not okay to be a nerd and to like nerdy stuff.
Sorry, that starts at 3 and 5.
Oh, golly.
that kind of message, which is so hard to counteract. And it would be great for, I don't know, great for that to change. Certainly really good for schools, I think, to be much more aware of that, and to help manage the messages that they give to girls, because you're a bit of an outlier, if I may say this, in terms of your promotion of that. So that's not happening in a lot of homes necessarily. We really need to give girls more generally that exposure to those messages, and there are some great programs doing that. But one of the things I will say as a slight challenge to you, Sue, is that now you're not, you know, now you're working in business improvement and strategy. So how does anyone know you're an engineer?
It's a really interesting question. And because, you know, what happens as you sort of mature through your career is, you know, your resume, for example, you don't have some of the early things. I am guilty of making sure I put that up forefront, and in the profile that I've got, like on LinkedIn and that sort of stuff, is I often try to refer to, as an engineer, at some point in that, you know, as an engineer, I'm skilled at seeing a problem through a lot of diverse skills, and I'm capable of looking at the technical problem and at the adaptive problem, at the strategic problem or the cultural problems, and blend those two together to get a whole of, you know, of operational model improvement. And because everything you want to do from a business improvement perspective is around people, process, or systems. And, you know, the engineer in me knows how to bolt all of those together. So the problem solving is the same. It's just what I'm trying to problem solve on now is different, perhaps, from whether a conveyor can take, you know, 100 tonnes an hour, 150 tonnes an hour. They are more complex. And I do think the engineering brain really suits that kind of complex problem solving. And so I do try to still put that in. So the only reason that people would know I was an engineer is if I choose to still celebrate that. Yeah. And for a little while, I thought I'm going to hide that because it's going to pigeonhole me into a technical role, and I don't really want to necessarily work in only technical engineering or technical problem solving for the rest of my life. I'd like to apply that to a broader organisational context or to a broader strategic context, because I find that, you know, that complexity way more challenging and a lot more interesting now than some of the traditional technical engineering problems I've worked on. And so I kind of hid it for a little while, thinking that maybe, that would help me bounce across into other projects that I wanted to do. And actually, I think, Karen, I probably have to put this one back to you, because I think it was actually working with you that I made the connection that having both, kind of that strategic lens and the engineering problem solving lens, was actually kind of my secret, was kind of like a secret power, and that I should think about how I position that differently. So if I hadn't had an opportunity to explore that problem with somebody and tease that out, I probably wouldn't have realized that I actually need to keep celebrating being an engineer in order to A, be a successful professional for me in the careers I want to do. But it also means that the door is always open to a lot of the female engineers working in or around me at the moment to talk to me about that journey and how I went through it. So it's an interesting question. How do people know that I'm an engineer if I don't tell them?
That's right. And it's a fantastic story, because it's all about the relevance of engineering to a whole range of different career paths and different roles in organisations, and that in a sense it gives you the opportunity, particularly in your organisation now, which is very engineering based and has a lot of engineers in it. You're a great translator, and you bring that great gift of the strategic sort of mindset to that. It is best of both worlds. And as you know, and as you're doing fantastically, presenting your story and putting your story together and making it clear that engineering was the sort of the start of your journey, and it's been what's been a major contributor to your success, is a great story to get out to girls and women to help encourage them into engineering.
And I was, I've got to throw some kudos to my dad here. He's an engineer, and he and I competed terribly over those. I went to the same university he went to, and I was always planning to get higher marks than him, which I did. And, you know, so we had this constant conversation, a constant game. And over the years in mining, actually, there was quite a few pieces of equipment that I decommissioned that he built in the 70s because I'd come to end of life. So we've had a lot of fun with it. But he'd also said to me, you know, just doing an engineering degree, look at what I do today. And what he was working on at the time was very, very different. Or he was, you know, general manager for Southern Region on something, or he'd been working in construction, or he'd work, you know, and so he'd also emulated for me that an engineering degree is a ticket to a very open, broad and diverse career if you want it to. You can also pick a purely technical if that's what drives you and is your passion. But, you know, that it didn't have to just mean that you were going to be a technical boffin for the rest of your life. And it was really a ticket to some really amazing ways of thinking about problems and solving them differently. So I think I also did, I was lucky enough to get some of that lesson early before I even started my engineering degree. And that's something for me to think about as well. What message am I giving out about the same? Am I giving out a similar message? Because that was clearly an enabler for me at the time.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic story. Any last piece of advice or lesson that you learned that you'd like to share?
This is a tricky one. I'm going to have a quick look at my notes because we've covered so much. Around all of that. I think ultimately, you know, there's a couple of things around gender that I wanted to talk about. And I said, you know, I think this issue around gender and leadership is critically important. I think one of the next challenges for us as a community is going to be around sort of non-genderless leadership, because we are more au fait now with the concept of people being non-binary. They're not just male or female. And watching that change happening in leadership now, where someone's not wholly female or wholly male, and how they fit in, unless an organisation has gone through that debate about female leadership or gendered leadership, they're not in a position to be able to have that debate. And that's a debate that is starting already, and organisations are already beginning to understand that. So I think we've got to keep this gendered concept of leadership on the table. It's not something that we've achieved yet, but gee whiz, we're coming a long way quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the other thing I'd say perhaps to younger female leaders who might be listening to this is, it's not one of those things that's going to solve itself for you overnight. It's something you're going to work on throughout your career. You're going to understand yourself. We're all going to work for somebody who doesn't help us. And we're hopefully, if you can find someone who does, find a way of getting on that project and work for the leaders when you get a chance and that you admire, male or female, because they will teach you about what kind of a leader you want to be, just as much as a bad leader might teach you about what you don't want to be. And as terrifying it is, that vulnerability, that seems to be the ticket to a really good leadership game. The more vulnerable and authentic you are prepared to be as a leader, the times in my career that I've been honest with myself and with the people around me about what I do and don't know and how I feel have almost always led to really good outcomes. And I've learned a lot from it. So I think that's, you know, as much as we want to be stoic, there's that point where you go, I just have no idea. Everybody in this problem together, let's work it out collectively. I will lead your way through this conversation, but I'm not going to tell you what the answer is because I just don't know. I think there's a couple of things in there. So hopefully that's good enough for a couple of words of wisdom. Not sure.
They're great words of wisdom. That vulnerability, but also, you know, the openness. And of course that, you know, you finish off with a recommendation for leaders to coach. So, you know, how much more aligned could we be?
That's great. True.
Yeah. Terrific. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time that you've spent thinking about the conversation we were having today. And I've really enjoyed the conversation too. And you're a great role model for many women and men and anyone who's thinking about being an engineer or a leader. So thank you very much for joining me.
You're so welcome, Karen. And thank you for the time that we've put in today, and also for some of the many wonderful conversations you and I have had over the last few years, and your great new book. I really appreciated having someone that I can brainstorm and talk to about some of these challenges, who's done perhaps a bit more thinking about it than I had at the time. So I really appreciate your help too.
So I think some of my thinking in your experiences was what did that. Great, great teamwork there, Sue. Take care. Thanks.
Yay,
thanks
team.
For joining us. Bye.
You too.